Welcome to Bioethics in the Margins. We are a group of bioethicists from different institutions across the country. This podcast represents our views and those of our guests, but we do not speak for our universities or medical centers, nor for any formalized bioethics organizations. Our mission is to bring marginalized topics and voices into the bioethics discourse. This podcast is hosted by Dr. Amelia Barwise, Associate Professor of Medicine and Assistant Professor of Biomedical Ethics at the Mayo Clinic, and Dr. Kirk Johnson, Assistant Professor of Justice Studies and Medical Humanities at Montclair State University. Please enjoy this conversation.
So welcome to another episode of Bioethics in the Margins. And this month, we're very excited to have a librarian with us. Her name is Laureen Cantwell-Jerkovic, and she is the head of Access Services and Outreach at Colorado Mesa University. And she's researched and published on information literacy instruction as a form of critical thinking activism within academic librarianship, librarians and institutional review boards, and other topics that pique her interest. She recently edited Intersections in Healing, Academic Libraries and the Health Humanities, and served as co-editor for Spatial Literacy and Public Health, Faculty Librarian Teaching Collaborations. Her doctoral research, which was done and completed in 2024 at the University of Buffalo, focused on the caring labor of academic librarians engaged with reference and instruction work, and generated the theory of coactive caring for that labor. So you're very, very welcome, Laureen, and thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Thanks. I'm super excited. This is a big honor, what we're going to talk about today.
Great. Well, we wanted you to come on because we really wanted to talk about the issue of book banning. And we know this is something that you have an interest in and have a lot of knowledge about. So we're looking forward to learning more. So just to start us out, can you give us an idea of the extent of book banning in public libraries and schools and how those numbers have been changing over the last few years?
Sure. So just to take on the year component first, for example, in 2014, attempts to censor books, which encompasses both bans that maybe were successful as well as challenges, were 235. Total titles challenged in those attempts, there were only 183 unique titles. So there is some overlap in what gets challenged and banned at different levels. The most challenged title at that time was The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian. Come 2020, the attempts actually, you know, they were around the same number. The number of unique titles was actually a little bit higher. And the most challenged title at that time was Melissa, which was previously published as George. And some of these numbers were impacted due to closures during the pandemic. So we saw a little bit of fluctuation there. Then 2022, we peaked over 1,000 in terms of the attempts to censor. Titles challenged in that was nearly 7,000 and about 2,600 unique titles among there, with genderqueer as the most popular title. Numbers were roughly the same for 2023. I do think some good news here, if there's any, is that the numbers are looking a little bit down this year, but also one of the difficult components is that these things have to be reported to ALA to actually fit into their statistics. So that's something really interesting to think about, is that it takes quite a bit of work to go into documenting all this. So the libraries have to do the work to get the stats counted. And so a friend of mine who was a teen librarian probably saw 6 book challenges between 2020 and 2023, but none of them were actually reported to ALA. So just like with a lot of other statistics, when you're relying upon reporting for the documentation of it, there are plenty of times where the numbers are actually lower than they might be in reality as well.
So you're saying that it's possible the numbers are higher, it's just they weren't reported, and so we could be undercounting the number of challenge books.
Absolutely.
Okay. Now, we know about book bans, but you also talk, as you mentioned there, book challenges. So what are the other ways that have been used to restrict reading material in libraries and schools?
Sure. So, book challenges are essentially a step towards a ban. Things don't go from zero to banned, right? First they're challenged. So that's why we end up seeing more challenges than actual full-on censorship being successful. The challenges make for work and make for fear-driven behaviors on behalf of librarians as well. So, what I want to pull from here is ALA's language, the American Library Association's language, that a challenge is an attempt to remove or restrict materials based on the objections of a person or a group. A banning is the removal of those items. So again, good news here, we have far fewer bans than we have challenges. But at the same time, some of what we do see are what I might call self-censorship or subtle censorship, soft censorship, where we get into librarians who are trying to avoid the hassle of fighting with the public about a particular item, where they may not display it in themed displays. They might weed it from the collection or not replace it should it be stolen or damaged. They might move it from a children's or a teen areas to an adult area that restricts access to it. So there are a lot of repercussions here of people almost trying to get ahead of challenges as well, where we're trying to make less fear-based, less contentious relationships with our communities, with parents and things like that. So challenges are sort of this middle ground between what we might do to get ahead of it or making things actually accessible and the ban actually occurring.
So, before I pass it over to Kirk, can you kind of talk a little bit about the different levels of book banning? Is it state driven mostly, municipality, county? You've shared a lot of great resources and articles describing specific efforts by a county to, for example, move a book from non-fiction to fiction because they didn't like the topic that was discussed. So just can you give us an idea of like what level are these book bans or book challenges coming from? I know they're often put forward by individuals, but how much of sort of how widespread are they when they come? Do they just affect small portions of libraries, or do they tend to impact a lot of libraries at the same time?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's a lot of nuance to this. I would say, in a great way, this rarely happens at the federal level. So yay for that. At the same point, I think things tend to start at county, school district, municipality level, and can move up from there. Again, it rarely hits the federal level, but I think the state level is certainly a possibility and certainly a reality that we're seeing. So because these start as more local conversations, the way that this operates is you have a request for a reconsideration form, typically at a public library. And so if someone has a complaint about something, they get that request for reconsideration form. And at least at the public library level, how this works, it goes to the librarians who do the collecting. It goes to the library board, the library director. It goes to this board of individuals who are charged with this reconsideration. They have to review the book. They have to write a formal response to the patron. It tends to be a long process that takes a good bit of time because you're trying to handle it carefully. It is actually a good thing that people have an option to voice these concerns, but you also have to treat them carefully. And you have to, we're taking responsibility for our collection. And so, that taking responsibility comes with responsibility, right? And in how we handle it. So I guess when we're thinking about how these are enacted, it's typically often individuals, very often parents, who are trying to be protective, we'll say, of what minors or non-adults have access to through their library, and including what they're assigned to read through classroom contexts. So there are some groups behind this. It's not always individuals. Moms for Liberty is a pretty well-known group. And one of the reasons why we've seen an uptick in numbers, but not necessarily a huge uptick all the time in the last 3 years anyway, in the number of unique titles is because that's a group that passes around their list. Okay, so we're seeing more challenges, but of the same set of items. We might have, of the top 10 books every year, we might have three new ones. But it's a lot of the same books that come up again because people are, you know, working in this district to do it, or working in that district to do it, because they've been handed a list and almost like a call to action of, you know, if this is on your shelves, you need to get it off. You are responsible for trying to get this out of people's hands. So there's this mentality of a public good, of something protective, and we can get into the paternalistic and colonialistic type mentalities that go into these things, but that's kind of largely how it happens. If we do want to get into some of the legislature, for example, I think in Utah, if a book is removed, maybe even just challenged at three schools successfully, it needs to be taken out of all of the schools. So that's how it can kind of go into the state level. So if they create a policy at a state level that embraces what may be happening at the local level, it can have a statewide impact. So that's kind of important to consider.
Yeah, thank you, Lauren, and it's great to see you as well. I'm just curious to have a follow-up question with what you mentioned. And my question is, I don't know if there's any statistics that you have in front of you or just off the top of your head, but I guess what percentage of those books that are being banned are those literally within a margin, since we are bioethics in the margins, are those individuals that, you know, are, you know, a person of color or might be part of the queer community or might be more about women, you know, those demographics, those groups that have historically been oppressed, dehumanized, whatever particular terminology you would like to use. I don't know if you know the percentage of those particular demographics that these the books that are being banned are part of those demographics.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a direct percentage, but what I can say is that a lot of the reasons why the majority of books have challenged remain the same, but, you know, so they're getting into concerns about sexually explicit content, offensive language, you know, so it is about the content, but I would say the majority of the books that you're going to see on this list, on these kinds of lists annually, they're not, I think I had some funny examples, believe it or not, but they're not, you know, they're not Charlotte's Web. They're not Harriet the Spy, because you're teaching my child to spy on people, right? They are focused on, there are books that have a racial component. There are books that have instances of sexual assault that come up. There are books that have LGBTQIA content. So I would agree that I think that it's the vast majority of it. And I would even think statistically, like if I were an author and I were writing a book. So I think a good example is Saeed Jones's How We Fight for Our Lives. He has a line in there that says, being black can get you killed, being gay can get you killed, being a black gay boy can get you killed. And I would add to that, being a book about a black gay boy can get you censored. So there's, you know, there is some almost predictability to the content at this point that will come up in challenges. And I think that's, it's a really unfortunate component of it, because there's, I think the quote I have from the author of The Perks of Being a Wallflower is that banning books gives us silence when we need speech. It closes our ears when we need to listen. It makes us blind when we need sight. And so when you're talking about taking those narratives away from readers, you can actually think pretty specifically about what we are silencing, who we are silencing, what we're not hearing, and what we're not seeing, right? We're not seeing those narratives, which when it comes to fiction, nonfiction, but predominantly fiction, you miss out on parts of the world. Your brain is not taught to be in those shoes, to be in those perspectives. And that has huge societal ramifications when we are shielding those narratives from people.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, every lived experience is important because, of course, everyone lives in their own world, lives in their own shoes. And as you said, it is a disservice, I think, where the only worldview that is seen and is really disseminated is your own worldview, but other worldviews aren't, unfortunately. Even though you disagree, I think it's still important to at least have those worldviews accessible for everyone to understand.
Sure. And similar to the same logic of, you know, Barbie's not just tall, crazy thin, big boobed and blonde anymore, right? It's because people need to see themselves in the world that they're living in. There's a lot of value to that. There's a lot of kids that I know you work with college kids, and you know I work with college kids, and we know how often they spend time thinking that everybody else in the room is smarter than they are. Nobody else in the room has the problem that they have. There's a lot of isolation that people experience when they think their problems are only theirs. And so whether it's a memoir, whether it's a graphic novel, whether it's pure fiction, there's a lot of value into understanding that you're not alone. I would add to that, though, some of my favorite quotes about the value of reading come from a Neil Gaiman article in The Guardian in 2013, which I'm having trouble believing is over a decade ago because it's so at the front of my mind when I think about my job. But part of what he says is, we navigate the world with words. And as the world slips into the web, we need to follow to communicate and to comprehend what we're reading. People who cannot understand each other can only go so far. When you watch TV or see a film, you're looking at things happening to other people. Prose fiction is something you build up from 26 letters and a handful of punctuation marks, and you alone, using your imagination, create a world and people it and look out through other eyes. You get to feel things, visit places and worlds you would never otherwise know. You learn that everyone out there is a me as well. You're being someone else, and when you return to your own world, you're going to be slightly changed. You're also finding out something as you read, vitally important for making your way in the world, and it's this. The world doesn't have to be like this. The world can be different, right? So there's all these things that open up through reading, and not being able to step into someone else's shoes is a huge problem. I'll soapbox for just a second and let you ask me more questions, but when he talks about the value of being able to build empathy through reading fiction, I unfortunately immediately start thinking about mass shooters. And I'm going to put some levity into this just because it like hits my heart too bad. And I have to try to like make something humorous happen when that happens to me sometimes. But I think about Elle Woods, right? Happy people don't kill people. I also think people with empathy for others don't take those movements, because you have to sit there and think, wow, what is this going to do to other people? And so I would love to see people researching what happens if you had a fiction-based intervention for young males at risk. You know what I mean? To see if being able to build empathy also helps lift them up and also helps change how we think about ourselves as sort of lone wolves in society. Because as we're saying, you know, we tend to self-isolate. We tend to make ourselves feel and think we're more alone in our problems than we are. And these books do help expand that idea that we are not. and help us look beyond that and think about other people and ways that we are part of things and envision other lives. And that's so, so important.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting, too, that you said that, because I know this is, you know, a Bioethics in the Margins podcast, but of course, we're not born in our professions. You know, Amelia wasn't born a doctor, right? You, of course, go through the process, but we all start off as kids, right? We all start off as children. And it's interesting you said that, unfortunately, because of the different material out there that is being banned, and a lot of children don't really get access to different lived experiences. And that child grows up, of course, eventually into adult and wants to go into medicine. I know there's no statistics out there about that or any type of research, or maybe there is at the very beginning stages, who knows. But it's interesting, the humanistic dynamic of future healthcare professionals that grew up in particular school districts that had these banned books and really didn't have access to the stories of people that eventually they're going to treat, right? Eventually they're going to serve in many different capacities in the clinical setting. So, yes, this is not a traditional Bioethics in the Margins topic, but eventually it is interconnected in many ways in patient care and how we view the other, how we view folks that don't look like us, and really look into the shoes of that person as well. So, absolutely.
Yeah, and it's fun how this dovetails with how you and I met over the Health Humanities book that I was working on, because absolutely, I'm trying to find where my example is in my notes, just because it fits what you're saying very well. Because what I'm thinking of is, you know, if you become a physician and you don't know the origins of, like, the historical origins of something like gynecology, you know, I feel like, I'll say as a woman, I feel like that's a thing I would like, in particular, a male gynecologist to be aware of and be able to contextualize when you are talking to me about my body, when you're talking about my options, when you're talking about my care and the instruments you're about to use on me and all of that. Like, I would want you to have that awareness to bring into things, because I think it should impact how you approach it. But one recent example that came up in Montgomery County of Texas was with a book called Colonization and the Wampanoag Story. This book was written by, no joke, a Native American historian, Linda Coombs, and it was anonymously challenged locally. And who got together to talk about this? Well, it was a county appointed citizens review committee that did not have any librarians, anyone with a literature or writing background on it. And their thought was, let's shift it from nonfiction to fiction. Think about the ramifications of that, of the idea that you can take a lived experience of a people. So again, think about the experiment on female slaves that occurred that started off gynecology, and think about if that were shifted into fiction and the impression that that would give a reader of the world around them. Right. And this is legit, like, scary logic. Good news. There was a lot of backlash about that choice because, of course, it hit the papers. And not only anti-censorship advocates, but plenty of others got involved in the conversation. And as of yesterday morning, they have confirmed they are keeping it in nonfiction. But just the fact that we're having this conversation about whether a Native American historian can write actual history of Native Americans in the country that was theirs, and whether we can classify that as fiction or not. That was one of the, I guess, weirder things I had heard lately, which I was like, I would almost rather you put it in special collections or something. Like put it in an archive where at least it feels like it's still history, but maybe it's a little harder to get to. I would never want the Native Americans of America to actually see us putting that in fiction. That would be horrifying.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to shift a little bit, because definitely be on this topic for the rest of our conversation with you, and of course I'll bring it back to Dr. Barwise, my friend and colleague Amelia. I'm curious, in the past few years, are there any changes? Has this evolved in any particular way? Are there any type of books, the books that are being banned, are they changing? And also the people that are, still advocating to ban books, is that demographic changing as well? Or it's basically the same type of content, as you mentioned before, and the same, individuals or the same group of people?
I think there are some shifts to the kinds of books, but maybe not in the way that you would expect. So, I know we've talked about how some of the predominant themes and some of the prominent reasons for challenging content are sort of sticking with the same course. I also think that some of the a large portion of the people who are challenging and pursuing censorship of these items tend to be the same. There tends to be either a paternalistic, I'll say colonialistic, or a religious component, if not all three of them. If you think about some of the history of Christianity across the world, that kind of dovetails in a really horrible triumvirate. So I think a lot of those are the same. However, some of what we're seeing, it's not, as I mentioned before, like these sort of strange examples of like Anne Frank's diary being a downer, which was, I'm not kidding, a reason, or Charlotte's Web or Harriet the Spy. It's not a light in the attic anymore. Which was, I think one of the issues there was it promotes breaking dishes instead of doing them. It's not a light in the attic anymore. It is pretty typically along racial and sexuality lines, specifically. And if it dovetails, as I said earlier, all the more likely that something's going to be pursued. But in terms of the kind of content, graphic novels are a really interesting thing to talk about here, where they're visual, they have pictures, they're often short with fewer words than a full than Harry Potter, right? So you think pictures, not a lot of words, this is for kids. And there's a whole genre of adult graphic novels. There's pornographic adult graphic novels. And so not everything with pictures is for kids. And so sometimes things are getting into the hands of kids who are not at that level yet, where it is content that is too mature for them. So that's a thing. I think what I want to stress here is that librarians do believe in age-appropriate materials. Youth librarians, youth services librarians read thousands of reviews every year. They curate things really carefully. They really actually care about kids' growth and development. That said, parents, if you're letting your kids loose in the library and they're just grabbing stuff, how much of that is on the librarian at that point? Because we buy for the whole community in a public library. So those are things to think about. And at the end of the day, what it comes down to, if you don't want your kid reading it, that's fine. But your kid is not the only kid in the community. And so if I do have a teenager who has, sexual identity questions and things like that, and I'm that parent and I want them to be able to read that, that is also a viable thing to do. One parent is not the parent of the entire community, but they may be the loudest voice. So when you have these lists being passed around, you have someone who's empowered to kind of be that voice and be that problem at your school board meeting or at, you know, meetings ahead of local elections and things like that, when bills are on the docket for consideration. You have these people who can be these loud voices, but it's okay to reconsider a book. It's okay for libraries to have contentious materials to provide access to information. And we do care whether age-appropriate things end up in people's hands. But that doesn't mean that there should not be a diversity of stories, that there shouldn't be a diversity of worldview that people are presented with. So I guess I would just add that that graphic novels are a good example of that. I would also add that certainly over the last, I'll say 10 years, but it's certainly ramped up over the last five, content that addresses critical race theory has taken a lot of heat as well. This is due to whoever is being that loud voice in the community feels it's making white kids feel bad. It's emphasizing racial differences. They may think it's promoting anti-police or anti-cop mentalities. And I can give you some examples of books that fit that bill. But again, that's where the race component has a spike and sexuality components has a spike. And I would add, when we bring up the anti-cop component, authority, right? And that's what the whole theme of what's going on here is. It's these concepts of control and who has authority over what. So of course, something that questions, I'll say, a typical lens on authority, even though anyone who's read the 1619 Project knows the origin of police has a very complicated history as well, and not a fictional history. You know, these lenses of authority really kind of come up here. So instead of Harriet the Spy, you know, lying, it's now we're anti-cop because we highlight that there are differences in how races are treated by authority figures.
Well, thank you for that. And thank you also for mentioning that story and the update that actually was able to stay. That story about how Native American men were treated was actually able to stay in the nonfiction section. So that was really a result of advocacy on the other sort of from other perspectives. Are there any other ways that book bans can be reduced or stopped? I mean, is there legislation or other policies that can be used, or is it really down to librarians and other parents and the public kind of recognizing the importance of these materials and arguing for them to be available to the public?
Yeah, that's an important thing to think through. So I am a little bit a believer, you know, think globally, act locally. I think, you know, being a voice in your community is hugely important. And again, these bills aren't starting at the federal level. They're starting in your county. They're starting in your school district. They're maybe escalating to your state. So just like I heard, I was at a presentation at a Constitution Day last year, I think, and someone was, you know, talking about like, well, how can I feel like my vote makes a difference, right? And he said, honestly, vote locally, because, you know, your local goings-ons impact your state, and your state goings-on impact the national stuff. So there's a lot that I think local activism and being present and being part of those school board meetings and being part of your city council conversations and staying aware of that stuff. I do think that that's super important. I think legislation also gets tricky in the sense that if we are looking at things nationally, well, one, we already have the First Amendment, and sometimes the complexity of that issue is that you get people on both sides wanting to limit speech, and that's a really muddy area to explore. I've seen it when I was an undergrad. I've seen those conversations happen, and it's scary to be in them when you have people who love and care for, I'll say maybe the hurt party or the marginalized party, saying we should have a list of words that don't get said. And you're like, ooh, that starts a whole other problem, right? So the freedom of speech component, the First Amendment component, does make for a complex lens on legislation. Advocacy is very, very powerful, which is why when we think about the Freedom to Read Foundation and the American Library Association and the ACLU, at least with the first two, they're not necessarily starting the suit. They might be writing an amicus brief to go along with something, right? So there are ways that we can participate in legislature as advocates as well. So those are interesting things that we can think about. I think that there are also some other ways that we can even consider coming at this. I was thinking earlier this week about how, oh gosh, I hate to bring the Kardashians into this, but a few years ago, number of years ago on Instagram, Kim Kardashian took some heat because there was a sponsored post that she did not make clear was a sponsored post. Those are interesting things to think about when we think about misinformation and disinformation and whether things are opinion, who's an authority on what. On the same token, we've also seen this year the enactment of the AI Act in the European Union. And that has some interesting context to it too. Standards for transparency, facilitating complaints about how AI may have been leveraged for something. But what I want to stress here is the idea of AI not being able to be used to deliberately impede informed decision making. So this is all to say, like maybe what we don't want to come at it with is you can't use these words or you can't have this on the shelf. But maybe we are thinking about how we can be advocates in ways that aren't endangering the First Amendment as well, is I think where my head is going. We're like, we know AI is out there, so I don't think it's going away, but are there some guardrails that don't attack AI but also empower people? And are there ways that we can look at this that way too? I'm trying to see if there's anything else I want to add here. I think Colorado, in terms of legislation, just put into play because it's a 2024 Senate bill. It only requires libraries to follow their collection policy and says librarians can't be fired or sued for refusing to remove challenged books. Illinois upholds the ALA Bill of Rights. There are things that states can kind of put in their constitution that protect libraries in terms of legislation. It just so happens there's other states that are kind of going that other route too.
Yeah, well, that sort of brings us to something I wanted to ask about, and that's this idea of criminalizing librarians, similar to abortion providers. So it sounds like some states actually protect librarians, so librarians can keep things in their collections, even if there's various moves to try to challenge books or remove them. But obviously, that's state by state. Some states won't protect librarians then.
Yeah, or at the very least, there are states that are entertaining proposals.
Okay.
I'll put it that way. There are states entertaining proposals for how the work of librarians can be limited or contested. And by the way, these concepts go back a long while too. Some of these cases go back to the 1870s. There's the Comstock Act, which made it illegal to send obscene, lewd, or lascivious, immoral, or indecent publications through the mail, but it also made it a misdemeanor for anyone to sell, give away, or possess an obscene book, pamphlet, picture, drawing, or advertisement. So you could see where libraries would be kind of in a hot seat for that situation. I don't know if we give things away so much as loan them, but if you don't give it back, I guess we gave it away. And come 1932, it was actually Random House that helped work through that. So, you know, publishers, corporate America has some avenues here too. And that one was all about James Joyce's Ulysses, which they found a way to like have the French edition caught at customs or something, and then filed a suit that like it couldn't, you know, it couldn't be banned. It's fine. And actually made it, want to double check myself here. You know, to Court of Appeals and district judges who were like, no, it's not obscene. And that, that became the first English speaking, we became the first English speaking country where the book was freely available. Other countries actually have problems. So like, we do have some successful records of saying like, no, this book is okay. We can say that this is okay and this is allowed. But there's so much volatility now around certain topics. It's so politicized. There's power and money driving these conversations too. As I said, it's the loud voices, and typically the loudest voices in the marketplace of ideas tend to be the ones with power and money.
Just to bring back the, I thought you just mentioned publishers. I mean, do they ever get involved in these, or do they just kind of feel that they're going to be outgunned and they may as well just not take a stand about their book?
I mean, generally speaking, publishers love libraries because libraries help make readers. Libraries get books in people's hands. How many times, if you were trying to, you know, get a local copy of Harry Potter, did you say, well, I don't want to wait 86 weeks. I'll just go buy it, right? Libraries make readers, or you find something that your kid likes and you buy them the box set, right? So there is a good relationship there. And I'll add that I had a good example of this. There was a book a couple years ago, Genderqueer, actually one of the most challenged books of the last few years. September 22, The Hill published an article noting that in the U.S. alone, in I think just May of 2022, because of all the media coverage about the challenges on it, sales increased 130%. You know, there's scratch off calendars of banned books. People get into that. People get into knowing that they're reading something that other people might have a problem with, and they want to see why. It can be a curiosity driven thing. There's a lot of drivers for why someone might explore that content. And some of it is just to say, you're not going to tell me what to read. So we have powers as consumers. There's corporate level support. There's all sorts of different ways that we can kind of come at that issue. Yeah.
Okay. And just before I hand it back again to Kirk, sort of moving a little to a different topic, you published an article called Truth or Consequences, exploring the role of librarians in nurturing critical thinking and information literacy. So can you explain those terms to us and why these skills and this way of understanding information is so important?
Sure. So I'll say from criticalthinking.org, critical thinking is the intellectually disciplined process of actively and skillfully conceptualizing, applying, analyzing, synthesizing, and or evaluating information gathered from or generated by observation, experience, reflection, reasoning, or communication as a guide to belief and action. So that's a lot of words. That's a lot of verbs there. But I think some of the things I think about there is in terms of actively and skillfully conceptualizing, applying, et cetera, through evaluating information. If you've ever had to come up with like learning outcomes for your syllabus or anything, you know, those are higher order thinking skills. So critical thinking, it becomes something that undergirds and supports these higher order thinking skills that we are really charged as citizens of a global community to use all the time, and a local community, but we are charged with using these all the time. But you need the skills to employ and deploy those responsibilities. than information literacy, and I'll bring this from the Association of College and Research Libraries, which defines it as the ability to identify when information is needed and the ability to access, evaluate, use, and understand the legal and ethical implications surrounding information. So when we're thinking about whether I, as a member of a community, have access to a particular book that I would like to read, doesn't matter, minor, whatever, like, we'll just say I'm an adult, I'm a white lady, whatever. I, you know, if there is an item that I want to read and I'm being told we had to take that off the shelves because it was challenged, I then should be information literate enough to say, well, I want to understand why. And I want to see if there's other ways I can get a hold of it because I still want it, to evaluate whether those reasons are appropriate or not. Do I agree with that? How do I use this information I've learned to make change locally or not? Do I want to make arguments? Do I want to go on the school board? Right? What do I do with this information? And is this legal? Is this ethical that we're making this choice? Again, these information literacy, critical thinking, they're just two-word phrases. They sound, you know, pretty straightforward. Then you unpack them and you realize how much of our sort of our intellectual survival depends on using these kinds of skills all the time. And that's why when we did that article, my friend Heather and I, when we did that article, it was because I kept thinking, man, these are the things that should prevent me from just going along with something, from being handed a list and being told, if these are in your library, get them out. And then following that order. There's a great quote that I found that I think kind of gets at it really well, which is that, I know it's somewhere here. I'm sorry for the weird pause. education makes a people easy to lead, but difficult to drive. Easy to govern, but impossible to enslave, right? So when you think about critical thinking and information literacy, those are relying upon, you know, being able to read, being able to communicate, being able to understand and consume information. So that's where education plays a huge component in all of this. But it also means that it gives you freedom, right? It gives you that ability to change the world. There was another quote I caught. There were just like so many quotes I came across last night. I was a little overwhelmed by myself. But education is the key that unlocks the golden door to freedom. That's George Washington Carver. How many years ago, right? You have education breeds confidence. Confidence breeds hope. Hope breeds peace. That's Confucius, right? So we know the power of education and critical thinking and information literacy. We've known it for ages, but that's exactly why when you take things away from people, right? We've seen this with Jim Crow laws. We have seen this time and time again. When you take things away from people, it impedes their ability to progress. It impedes their ability to fight. It impedes their ability to make change. And as that one particular quote says, hope and peace, right? These are good things that ostensibly we all want. But if you don't know what's going on and you can't understand it and you can't access information about it that you have the ability to evaluate and use and think about legally and ethically, how can you do that? How can you get to hope? How can you get to peace? How can you make change? So again, these are, I think, deceptively simple concepts and terms that have huge societal implications.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And to shift a little bit to your role as a librarian, which of course you're really are right in the thick of all of this, in the banning of books and trying to do your best in the midst of the book banning to really help people understand propaganda versus, you know, truth versus fact. And I'm curious, what is the role in your perspective of libraries and librarians in mitigating misinformation, and has it been bypassed by you know, the political right? Because obviously, the political right, for the most part, is the demographic that want to ban books for, you know, various reasons.
I think this circles back to something I was talking about a little bit earlier about concepts of control and authority. And I'll start this by making the same claim that I tell students when we're learning, believe it or not, strategies for searching Google, which seems like something shocking to talk to college students about because they're probably on Google 8 times before they even come to class, right?
Right.
But there are strategies for using Google. And I tell them, you know, Google, it's great. I use it all the time. It is a .com. It has algorithms, right? But if you know how to use Google, you kind of take back some of that control yourself, okay? I think, unfortunately, we're living in a really fast-paced, information-saturated, not necessarily good information-saturated. You've got mis and mal and disinformation going on all over the place. We're living in a situation where we are ceding control to a lot of things. And when you have these pursuits of challenges and censorship, those are people who are trying to take control, right? And if we're not informed, and if we're not vocal against those things, if that's where our viewpoint falls, we are ceding control to a more vocal people. So when it comes to misinformation and trying to mitigate it, what I think a lot of librarians are doing are trying to teach students how to go about research, to value information seeking as an activity that I tend to reinforce with them is self-protective. These are not things that you should be doing just because your professor told you to, right? And the notion of truth is really complicated now, and it has been for a really long time, which is why the First Amendment exists in the way that it does, because truth evolves over time. And if we don't let information out because eventually it could be proven false, that's a problem. So I've been reading a book by Jeff Kossoff called Liar in a Crowded Theater, which is about misinformation. And one of the things that's really been on my mind this week is his conversation about how the First Amendment empowers the speaker, right, against punishment for the act of speech, which comes in a variety of mediums now. But the First Amendment also empowers the listener with responsibility. And that is the conversation we don't have very often. And I think that's the conversation we need to have more, because we all know, we on this call and this podcast, we know that there are countries and there are societies where the listener is not empowered with responsibility because the listener isn't empowered at all. You don't have access to the information. You can't search for that. You can't write an opposing viewpoint about something. Okay? So we are in a country where they do have that power, but with that power comes that responsibility component as a listener. And that's where I'm talking about ceding control and how dangerous that is, because we are having conversations where it's like, give me the facts, give me the TikTok version, give me the bumper sticker version of what's going on with the economy or how to fix immigration, right? And those aren't simple topics. There aren't simple solutions. There are 85 different solutions, and 30 of them could go great, 40 of them could be terrible, and 10 of them are meh, right? There's so many different ways things could go. And by wanting to be spoon-fed one person's version of the truth and only accept that and ride that out with confirmation bias for the next 20 years, that's a big problem. These, I believe, are the conversations that I'll speak for myself specifically in academic librarianship we are trying to have. I do not want to tell you what your viewpoint should be. I want to teach you to find evidence and construct arguments that make sense and that acknowledge alternative perspectives and viewpoints and worldviews but that that give you a sense of control for pursuing information, for pursuing answers and evidence yourself. It is about when we're mitigating information, we are trying to empower individuals. We are trying to build independent, lifelong learners who understand that they have a responsibility. That is their power, is that they can look for this stuff and make determinations for themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. That is a great a way to, we could talk another hour about this, but obviously we're not. That's a great way to end, really empowering people to think critically and to decipher and discern information in a way that doesn't oppress them in any way or doesn't mislead them in any way, but really gives them the opportunity to make an informed decision, informed choice, informed opinions, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, have an opinion. Be informed. Don't put trash out there because you can. Have an opinion. Be informed and point people to actual evidence. Give them links to your sources. If you're using data, show me where you got it from. Don't just do it because you can. Don't just do it because people will like it or click on it or heart it on Instagram or whatever. We shouldn't be doing things just for the retweetability of it.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, thank you so very much for sharing your thoughts and perspectives on an important topic. I think that we need to have more conversations about this at every level, because ultimately we want everyone to be well-versed and informed about all of the information that, literally hundreds of articles with the push of a button on our smartphones and our tablets. We want people to be informed. So thank you very much.
Absolutely. And I hope that a bioethics interested audience, kind of takes advantage of how this intersects with topics that they care about too.
Thanks so much for being here. It's a great conversation.
Thank you. It's been an honor and a privilege. And I wish you guys tremendous success getting this podcast out there and into the ears of really awesome people who listen.
Thank you for listening to another great conversation on Bioethics in the Margins. This podcast is hosted by Amelia Barwise and Kirk Johnson. Our producer is Elizabeth Chung. Our editor is Madeline Mahoney. Our theme music was written and produced by Pablo Cortes. We are grateful for the assistance of Wendy Jung, and Gargi Pandey is our creative director. Nicole Strand is our advisor, and Steven Sodecki is our senior advisor. Join us again next time.